This is Originally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Indiana University and EMSI, which is a leading provider of economic impact studies to colleges and universities around the world, actually, especially here in the United States, has put out a report that involves Indiana University Northwest. And to find out more about that report, who better to explain it than an economist? And that's why we have with us today Professor of Economics Micah Pollack from the Indiana University Northwest campus with us. And Micah, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Will you take a moment to explain what EMSI is all about and how they got involved with Indiana University on this project?
Yeah, absolutely. So EMSI specializes in impact analysis, among other things, where they use a very involved method of estimating how some spending impacts the economy as a whole in a region or an area so that they can do a prediction, like if you build a new building, what is the the total impact of that building? Not just what you spend on the materials, but also the income, the money you spend on the employees, and then the employees then spend that money in the community, and so you get an estimate of the total impact of something on a region like ours.
How long have they been working on this study for IU?
This is something we've been doing for the entire IU system wide, not just for IU Northwest.
Right.
And so I believe it's been in process for at least a couple of years now.
Oh, I see. Now, I know that there's an executive summary that you can take a look at, I think, on the IU Northwest page, if you want to check it out yourself. But it does go into some great detail, not only about the benefits, economic benefits, that is, that IU Northwest brings to the region, but also the region in general. If you will, first go down the list of things that the economic value of Indiana University study has shown about IU Northwest.
Sure. So we all kind of know that there's a value to you directly for getting a degree. You get higher earnings over your lifetime. Nationally, that's about $1 million earned more over your lifetime having a bachelor's degree. But that's very general, kind of national numbers. What this study allows us to do is put actual numbers on the value of an IU Northwest degree specifically. And they find that getting a bachelor's degree at IU Northwest increases your earnings on average by about $20,000 per year compared to someone who just has a high school diploma.
Wow. Now, what kind of impact, I guess, as far as investment's concerned, that the students put into their education, what do they seem to get back here besides the increase in earnings over a lifetime?
From the student perspective, for every dollar they invest in education at IU Northwest, they earn $3.90 back in lifetime earnings, which is a rate of return of about 18% per year, which is really good, especially in this environment right now.
Now, I know this report has some interesting facts and figures. It talks here in particular here about students and the benefits that they can derive from an education at IU Northwest. But also there's, a benefit that comes in being an alum as well, and especially businesses they may happen to work for. Tell us about that.
I think what you might be referring to is that, as our alumni, graduate and they earn higher income, they spend that income in the local community. And so IU Northwest adds about $220 million in added income to Northwest Indiana each year, or supports indirectly about 3,000 jobs just because we have people earning more money that have graduated from IU and as a result of their degree, which then in turn, they spend in the local economy, which in turn, supports more jobs.
Mm-hmm. I noticed that the information I got here talks about the impact being such a boost that's like hosting the World Series 37 times. Is it really that big?
Yeah, it is, and that's, per year, essentially.
Wow.
So, again, I think we all kind of know the direct impacts of education, but we don't often see the indirect impacts. And so that's the real value of this report. It lets you put a number on the indirect impacts on the economy of having a greater educated workforce, and those numbers are huge.
Now, I know that the top administration with Indiana University asked EMSI to do a very exhaustive study of each of the campuses and the areas in which they're in. Will you go through, as what's mentioned in the executive summary for IU Northwest, about the link that the campus has with the daily lives of people here in Northwest Indiana?
Sure. So we already mentioned the alumni impact. So when you graduate, you have higher earnings, which you then spend in the community. We also have an operation spending impact. So just the day-to-day operations on our campus add about $40 million in added income to the region, or support about another 1,000 jobs. And then we also have an impact of students who travel to the region either permanently or maybe commute from Illinois, and their spending also supports about another 100 jobs or adds another $4 million per year in income in Northwest Indiana, wow. as well as other things like visitor spending. You know, if they come and go to a sports event, they may end up spending some money in the region. And then our construction spending as well kind of has this multiplier effect as well. And this all kind of combines to, you know, IUN directly employs about 900 workers, but indirectly supports about 4,000 jobs. And our budget, you know, our annual budget is roughly $50 million, but it generates about $260 million per year in added income to the entire region.
Now, are these benefits that go out just beyond the Gary city limits, go out to just about every place in Northwest Indiana?
Yeah, so EMSI looks at the regional communities that we serve. And so for their definition, it was the five-county region up here in Northwest Indiana, Lake, Porter, Newton, Jasper, and La Porte.
I know that the arts and culture may have been a bit neglected here because of the coronavirus pandemic, but it's still very much alive. And I know that IU Northwest, in better times than times beyond the pandemic, looking to help improve things. What seems to be the benefits, according to the report that and the information from the EMSI team that worked on this, what's it seem to be here for Northwest Indiana?
Well, we actually bring in quite a few people as a result of visiting for arts events and theater events and the like. It's obviously been less because of the pandemic, but we do, just by visitor spending, traveling to the campus to attend some events, bring in about $200,000 a year in the regional community from spending that otherwise wouldn't be there if we weren't holding these events.
Now, since you're an economist in general, not only taking a look at IU Northwest here with the information from this report that was put together for the university, but in general how the economic situation is in Northwest Indiana, do you find that there's any surprises or any news that you may not have known about that you put together with the information you do for your studies and the indexes that you and your colleagues work on?
Sure. I mean, the economy is still kind of struggling or limping back. Here in Northwest Indiana, we're probably not going to be back to the level of employment we had, in the spring of this year until probably the spring of 2021. So we're looking at a very kind of long, drawn-out recovery. But there's still so much uncertainty depending on, what happens with the virus, whether we have a vaccine, how effective it is. One kind of recent change is that we've seen a real spike in cases in Northwest Indiana. Mm-hmm. And just from since September 21st, cases have more than doubled. Up here in Northwest Indiana per day on average. And, that's something that, we expected cases to rise in the fall when the flu season hit, but the weather's still nice, flu season's just beginning, and to already have that sharp of an increase is very concerning, especially because it's pushing some hospitals to, their capacity in terms of COVID patients and, potentially causing them to think about delaying, elective surgeries again, like they did in the spring.
Now, I bring the subject up because one of the other things that you do on a regular basis and you have during the pandemic is put together a Twitter feed that keeps up on a regular basis with all of this data that you get to go through. And you've mentioned, I'm sure, some of it right now, so the fact that we seem to find cases on the rise, the virus seems to be on the rise in places. Have you got any other information and come back from the other sources as to how it is affecting the economy in general beyond what we've seen already?
So we're seeing a lot of local businesses struggle to remain open. They have somebody come in that's possibly infected, and then they have to quarantine their employees and shut down for a while. And so it's been a lot of opening and shutting to deal with these sorts of things. And, that's really hard on small businesses that maybe don't have that much of a buffer to get through tough times. And they're having to find ways to deal with this long term. And it's very much becoming the new normal that, we're going to have masks, we're going to have social distancing, and you have to figure out how to operate your business in that environment, probably for the foreseeable future, at least through the winter, if not longer.
Have you seen any impact that may have come up here just recently in some of your later reports about the impact of now that the Governor Holcomb has put us into stage five, opening more things up to reopen after the complete shutdown?
Yeah, that's a great question. The rise in cases we're seeing now is probably not related to that, simply because it takes about 2 weeks for some policy change like reopening to start showing up in the data, simply because it takes time for people to be infected and tested and test positive. So this recent rise is probably not the result of that. My best guess is that it's probably related to Labor Day, which was, was 2 weeks exactly before the rise began. Wow. So we're probably seeing this current rise as a result of people, getting a little exhausted with social distancing around Labor Day and maybe having more outside parties and the weather's been nice and more gatherings. We're only going to just start seeing the effect of going to stage five in the next few days, in the following weeks. I'm not too optimistic that going to stage five will help anything. It's much more likely to make things worse at this point, in terms of the next few weeks.
Now, we know across the state line over in Illinois and Chicago in particular, they're very concerned about the Indiana figures on how the COVID-19 pandemic is affecting things. And, of course, it would have an effect on the city of Chicago and residents and people who work in Chicago, for that matter. Any thoughts about what has come out here, the fact that the city of Chicago may plop Indiana on this quarantine list along with a lot of other states?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's something that both that we're kind of all in. If Illinois could quarantine themselves from themselves based on the data, they probably would. So I don't think it's anything unusual about Indiana. I mean, we're all here in the Midwest, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, and other states all struggling right now with pretty bad outbreaks. And, quarantining and trying to limit travel is a way to kind of to deal with that.
What kind of impact might it have economically on Indiana if the mayor, because it's Mayor Lightfoot's idea to put it, I guess, on her staff to put Indiana on the quarantine list of states? What kind of impact might it have on Indiana economically here if it happens to stay on for a long time?
That's tough to say because I don't know if people will actually adhere to that or not. I suspect that the reasons they come to Indiana will probably still remain, and people will be likely to ignore that quarantine list. I mean, we've not seen really good care put in place to keep people quarantined. It's mostly kind of on your own enforced. There's no actual enforcement involved. So I think it picks up some news that maybe Illinois doesn't want their citizens traveling to Indiana, but maybe I'm a little bit negative here, but Illinois has always kind of discouraged people from visiting Indiana, right? I mean, we're not always the most desirable location, and even if they haven't officially said that before, I don't think this changes things that much.
Mm-hmm. Getting back here to the EMSI report that has been turned into Indiana University and the impact on Northwest Indiana, have you had a chance you and your colleagues on campus had a chance to share this information amongst yourselves and to get some other thoughts, what they think about this information? Probably a lot of it comes as no surprise to many people on campus.
Yeah, we have known for a long time that we have this broad impact on the whole community, but it's great to see actual numbers. I mean, a couple other numbers that just jump out is really important is that for every dollar taxpayers invest in IU Northwest, the taxpayers earn back $1.30 in added tax revenue and public sector savings down the road, which is huge. And for every dollar that society invests in IU Northwest, society, meaning state and regional, at the state and regional level, earn $8.50 back in additional revenue and social savings. So, it's great to be able to put specific numbers and give you some kind of scale for these benefits that are accruing to the region. We've always known that they're there, but being able to say it's, for every dollar, this is the return, it makes it much easier to kind of make the argument for higher education in Northwest Indiana.
Let me ask, since you've had a chance to look at this in great detail, and we can share this, and we have, I guess, in the highlights today, if anybody listening is interested in this in more detail, where can they get to see this report or make a copy of it?
The easiest way is just to search for Indiana University Economic Impact Study, and you can maybe add EMSI in there as well. Mm-hmm. If you follow me on Twitter, I've tweeted it out a couple of times, so that may be a more direct route. There's a really nice single-page fact sheet that just kind of graphically outlays everything and puts all the comparisons and numbers in it that, in just a single page kind of tells you everything that you need to know.
We've been finding out more about the study that Indiana University and all the campuses, for that matter, not just Northwest Indiana, has had set up with EMSI, which provides economic impact studies to colleges and universities across the country and around the world, for that matter. And we found out in particular how IU Northwest ranks in all that information with Indiana University Northwest Economics Professor Micah Pollack. And Micah, thank you for being with us today, and I hope we see more good news come out.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. It's been a pleasure.
You're welcome. This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
Gary was the place you went to shop, and when it was a very successful community, we either drove there, my parents drove us there, or when we got a little older, we would just take the bus to downtown Gary. And there was every kind of shop you could think of. And at Christmas time, it was shoulder to shoulder walking up to down the street doing Christmas shopping. It was thriving. I grew up in a Lake Station, which it was East Gary when I grew up in it. And in originally, it was Lake Station back in the 1800s and early 1900s. And then they changed their name to East Gary when, you know, the mills were starting to go and they wanted the executives to move there. So they changed it. Then when things got bad in Gary, they changed it back to Lake Station. I thought that is very telling. It was a typical suburban kind of neighborhood. It was very working class. In fact, there were going to high school there. Everybody's parents made about the same amount of money. They worked in the mills. So in that way, it was probably different than a lot of other places because none of us were aspiring to be the rich kid in school. There were no rich kids in the school. Patrick and I were married in 1966, and we moved to Miller in 1967, and we moved with a young baby. At that time, Miller was thriving. The downtown area had every kind of store you can think of. It was jewelry stores and bookstores and coffee shops and dress shops and Jack Spratt's ice cream shop, which was drew people from all over. And it was the funnel to the beach. I mean, hundreds of people would come to the beach during the summer from all over. It started to change really in the 70s. And with so many things, early 70s, late 60s, early 70s, with all of the things that were going on nationally and locally, you know, the war had an impact on the economy, the Vietnam War. The mills were at their heights and then started, you know, the economy was changing, the technology was changing so that less people were needed in the mills. And the whole suburban sprawl had an impact on little downtowns like Miller. It happened everywhere in the country, and it certainly happened here in Indiana with the other small communities. So at some point, there weren't a lot of businesses on the street, and those that were weren't thriving. A lot of the people left. They moved to Munster. That's how Munster got built. And the people who stayed are still here. But the whole dynamics of the community changed. The money went with them. You know, Munster's a thriving town. Maryville is in much better shape than Gary. So yeah, that's the impact. If Gary doesn't thrive, the rest of the area doesn't thrive. And I think that is critically important. We can't have part of our population barely surviving. The city of Gary has all the infrastructure, you know, the steel mills. It has so much going for it. We can't ignore it. It's like somebody in your family who has cancer and you're just going to ignore them because it's not going to affect you. Well, it is going to affect you. We all need to be good neighbors, and it's not just in Gary and Lake County, but in Porter County in Indiana. As a country, we have to not be so polarized because nobody's moving ahead.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. Many rural hospitals in the Midwest run on razor-thin profit margins, and the COVID-19 crisis added to their financial stress as many lucrative procedures were suspended. Emergency federal funding has provided some relief, but experts say that that's likely to be just temporary. Side Effects Public Media's Carter Barrett takes a look at the hospital's continuing struggle.
Indiana's Vermilion County is dotted with fields of corn and soybeans. It has only one hospital, Union Hospital Clinton. And though Union is small, only 25 beds, it also services parts of two neighboring counties with high rates of heart disease and stroke.
And so our relationships in this healthcare sector in our rural communities is a very vital source. And to take that away, you know, you think, what would that alternative future look like?
This is Stephanie Laws, the hospital administrator. When the pandemic hit, Laws was worried for this type of small rural hospital.
It was a balance and a challenge before the pandemic. The pandemic hit us hard.
The Clinton Hospital did not face a big COVID-19 outbreak and has some other advantages. It's part of a chain, and patient care here is more profitable than at other hospitals around the state. That offered some stability, Law says. Still, rural hospitals across the U.S. face mounting financial challenges. They're usually in communities with aging populations, rely heavily on reimbursements from Medicare and Medicaid that don't cover costs. So when COVID-19 forced them to suspend elective procedures, they took a big hit.
And so I can only imagine that just figuring out how you make payroll when a big chunk of your income suddenly goes away and might not return anytime soon.
That's Nirmina Kimmy, a professor of hospital finances at IUPUI Fairbanks School of Public Health. Before the pandemic hit, the average rural hospital in Indiana made less than 1% profit from patient care. An analysis from the Institute for Nonprofit News found that 3/4 of the nation's rural hospitals entered the pandemic actually losing money on patient care.
When we then, on top of that very fragile baseline, then had a pandemic and the resulting suspension of electives and skyrocketing prices of supplies and so forth, it was a double whammy.
This is Brian Tabor, president of the Indiana Hospital Association.
I was deeply concerned that we were starting to see what potentially could be the rash of closures across the country extend into Indiana.
And what saved these hospitals during the pandemic? Indiana medical providers received over $1.7 billion from the main federal aid package. The chain that runs the hospital in Clinton received close to $30 million for all of its facilities. Some Indiana hospitals spent it on equipment. Others used it to replace revenue from suspended elective procedures. Even federal aid has its limits. Phil Ellis is senior director of the Indiana Rural Health Association. He says some other aid, like accelerated Medicare payments, will come due. And while the federal government has extended the timeline, questions remain.
There are some questions as to the formula of what will be considered required in the payback versus what will be legitimately. It's still very much fluid.
Now these hospitals remain a critical part of our public health infrastructure. Professor Valerie Yeager of the Fairbanks School says hospitals often assist government health agencies.
You know, as a state, we invest about $12.50 per person in public health. And nationally, it's $36.
Experts say rural hospitals are crucial in continued COVID-19 testing and eventual vaccine distribution. Here's Laws again.
I mean, I'm encouraged yet despaired. You know, you really don't know what to expect, really. I mean, it could be one way today and it could be another tomorrow.
While hospitals are getting busier following the shutdown, they are far from normal. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Carter Barrett.
It's time once again to find out the latest from the Indiana Youth Institute with the president and CEO of the IYI, Tammy Silverman. And Tammy, thank you for joining us today on the program with another topic of discussion. Tell us about it.
My pleasure, Chris. It's good to be with you again. You know, it's that time where we're talking politics with our kids and how to approach the subject that is so much on everyone's minds as well as in our media right now.
Now, there's a report that is out from a study. I guess it was published actually back in March, and it's still good to hold through the day. Even now, this is close to the November general elections. Tell us about how this report seems to fit in well with what youngsters and teens in particular, since they're the ones that they are starting to get some exposure to politics by way of school, what they are talking about and they're concerned about.
Absolutely. Well, and the study said, even though sometimes we think that our kids aren't listening or aren't paying attention. This study actually said, and it was in the Journal of Child Psychiatry and Human Development, found that most children and teens do worry about politics and political issues, and that holds true regardless of their family's political affiliation. Mm-hmm. So because of that, we know that we should really be talking to our kids about these issues.
Well, how far should we really talk with them about them, these issues we're referring to, and does it basically depend on the age of the child as to what we can talk about?
Absolutely. You're 100% right, Chris. As with so many different things, they call it scaffolding or responses, right? It depends on the age of the child. The younger they are, the more simplistic and straightforward we need to be, and the older that they get, the more complex and detailed the conversations can be.
Now, when we talk about the issues of politics, we're talking more about Republican and Democrat and Libertarian and Green and all the other organized political parties, whether they're major or whether they are minor secondary, however you look at it. But we're talking in general about our system of government. And talking about our system of government in public is very important. What it seems to be the most important things that experts seem to agree on, I guess, as to what youngsters should know about and how we as parents or family members should go about talking with youngsters about.
Right. Well, a few things. First of all, you know, elementary, our young kids, talking about the basics of our systems, why we have elections, how it's beneficial that we have elections, you know, what are the goals of the campaigns, what are some of those, you know, what are some of the differences? And again, we don't always have to talk about the national elections. That's a really hard concept. You know, a lot of kids think that elections should be somewhat similar to, you know, a basketball game or a football game, that if 100 people vote and one candidate gets, you know, 80 and one candidate gets 20, the one with the 80 wins, right? And with the Electoral College, it's not quite that simplistic for presidential elections. So, you know, again, you might not start there with the youngest kids, but talking to them, and then the older they get, we can start talking about issues. The middle school kids, they're gonna ask you, what does it mean for them? So mm-hmm. Think about that and anticipate, what does it mean for my school if we're talking about elections? What does it mean for our home if we're talking about the economy? And then obviously high school kids, they're gonna test some boundaries and they're gonna throw out some opinions sometimes just to see what reaction they get from their family and friends.
We're talking with Tammy Silverman, the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute, concerned, of course, these days with the elections coming up and how to talk to youngsters of all ages, I suppose, about politics. And I suppose, too, isn't it, Tammy, that you're talking mostly about, at least at first, about showing to youngsters what differences really mean, that there are differences when we talk about politics, and youngsters should know about that probably first off, right?
Absolutely. And talk to them about, you know, if you can focus on the positive attributes of the candidates. You know, why does your family believe that this candidate is doing something that you all value and that you all believe in, rather than focusing on the negatives? We do know that kids, again, when they see and they see some of the ads and the TV ads or social media, all of those kind of things, they oftentimes, some of the negative, they actually identify as bullying. So mm-hmm. they pick up on negative really quickly. So again, if we as adults can frame it into, why is it important that we have elected leaders, and what are we expecting and hoping our elected leaders can do for our communities and our country?
Now we get to the point here now that we talk about trying to explain and get at least younger people to understand the differences and what the politics are all about, at least within whatever they can understand. But then there's also a point, too, that you can actually get them involved in civic society. What would be some of the ways that you could get youngsters involved in civic society and be able to understand the electoral process a little better?
Absolutely. So, you know, I think a lot of people have either gone with their parents to vote or have taken their kids to vote, and that's fantastic, right? So that they can see it firsthand, whether you do that early or if you do a mail-in or if you do a day of, you know, show them, talk about what you're doing. If they do have, you know, as they get older, if they have a specific issue or a candidate that they're really passionate about, figure out a way to help volunteer, whether that's, again, stuffing envelopes, making calls, walking a precinct. You know, let them volunteer and be part of the system and be part of our democracy and the election process. That can really shape how they're going to engage as they grow up.
Do you think that that's probably the good point to be able to show that you can agree to disagree about certain things?
100%. And we know that kids are going to encounter family members, friends, teachers, coaches, all, any of the above or all of the above that hold differing political values. And again, it's important for us as adults to show them that people can have different opinions, that we can even discuss them and we can disagree. At the same time, we need to recognize and respect each and every person as an individual human.
Now, I suppose that maybe CNN.com and FoxNews.com might be a little extreme for young people to get involved in, depending on the political stance. But there are some websites that are out there that are kid and teen friendly that can probably tell them a little bit about the news these days. Tell us about those.
Absolutely. So they calibrate, and they're gonna weed out some of that age inappropriate discussion that might not be right for little kids. There's Time for Kids, Scholastic Kids, News for Kids, Rock the Vote's a little bit more is a website that's geared towards high school and early college students, and then there's a whole gamut of books and games. And a lot of these are geared towards really little kids. You know, there's one, it was my kid's favorite, that was called Duck for President, mm-hmm. that really just talks about the election process. So again, early kids, even preschool kids, we can and should be talking to them about what's going on in our country and in our democracy, and there are ways to do it that is age appropriate.
Tammy Silverman's the president and CEO of the Indiana Youth Institute. And as always, Tammy, thank you for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Our thanks to our guests for being with us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we'll look in further into the flights that ICE has set up for immigration out of the Gary Chicago International Airport and other topics, including what the folks at the Hammond Public Library are doing these days in the midst of the pandemic. We hope you'll join us for tomorrow's program.